Hiya, so pleasure to introduce Eugene, who's going to be 47 years sober on the 1st of May, I think you said, Josh, yeah? And we're
Yep.
going to hand the meeting over to you. Welcome.
Thanks, Jan. How long do you want me to speak for?
However long that takes your fancy, yeah?
Okay. Okay, I'm Eugene and I'm an alcoholic. Or I like to think of myself as a drug addict because the only drug I ever used was alcohol. And I used it like a drug. The first drink I ever had lit me up. And I couldn't see any sense in not taking more because I liked the feeling it gave me. And very early in my drinking, I became totally obsessed with different brands of drink. And I started making drink and I started distilling drink. And my life revolved around it very, very fast. And it gave me freedom of relaxation and just feeling the power, I suppose, and being able to deal with things in life. I remember my first drink was a three Bacardis over a night, and I completely changed. I was in a pub in North County Dublin, and a guy came in. I was fixing watches at the time because I was a student and I was putting myself through college by doing little bits of, well, good few watches. And this guy brought a watch into me, and I looked at him and I just thought it was a great bit of fun to drop it into my drink, a high pint of Harp. And I tell them that that's very good for watches. So I did very strange things very quick. And I knew I'd be able to get it going again. I'd just clean it out and get it working again. But I did those sorts of things. And that night I nearly crashed a car. I broke a window by mistake. I was trying to get a girl's attention who was at a dance. And I didn't know what I was doing. And I broke a window and I slept out. And that was the start of my drinking career. And at no moment did I think myself, the drink is bad. Look what it made me do. I just couldn't wait to go again. And the following weekend, I tried Guinness and I had 3 pints of Guinness and I went home and I went to bed. I didn't want my parents to see that I was drinking. And I went to bed and the room started spinning around and I got up and I vomited. And again, it didn't say anything in my head to say that the drink was bad because it gave me that feeling again. And I learned how to keep drink down. And became a heavy drinker fairly fast. And at the end of my drinking then it just didn't work anymore. So there's 12 years in between the first drink and the day I was sitting in a pub in Ballyvaughan, not far from where I am at the moment, North County Clare, and a pint of Guinness in front of me, and I said, I can't do, it's not working anymore, and I'm finished. And I didn't drink that day. And the next morning, then I was dry retching, holding onto a wall. And I'd a broken foot. And I was trying to make my way back home again after being on the road for a few, well, 5 or 6 days. I hadn't gone. I was married and I had 2 kids at that stage. But I was trying to get back home, to get back to bed, to dry out and go to Alcoholics Anonymous because I had a quick look into Alcoholics Anonymous before. And I found all the differences between me and them. I could stop drinking any time because my willpower was so powerful, but I couldn't stay stopped. I didn't know that. I'd always drink again. And I was never in hospital, all the 20 questions. I wasn't in hospital to dry out or anything. I was in hospital because I fell down the stairs drunk, but I never was overnight in hospital. So when I saw one of the questions, were you ever in hospital as a result of drink, I said no because I read, I didn't, sometimes I didn't read what was written. I read, were you ever in hospital overnight? And so I was never in hospital overnight. So I didn't tick that box. Were you ever in prison cell? No. I was only in a prison cell one day. I wasn't overnight because police in Paris found me drunk on a building site and I was asleep, covered in human shit. I didn't know it. And so I didn't tick that box either. And so I went down and I drank for 5 days. At the end of 5 days, I was holding onto that wall. And I said something. I said, I'm fucked. I need help somewhere. And I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous and I've been going ever since then. And that was the 1st of May. Just this time of the year, summer coming. And I started listening, I suppose. I didn't like what I heard. I didn't like the religiosity in the big book. I don't want to spend the half the meeting talking about all that stuff, but it didn't appeal to me. The steps didn't appeal to me because I thought that there were some way, and especially with the steps and the big book, like the family afterwards and, two wives. And it was like trying, in my head, that they were trying to normalize me, get me to become a citizen again. And I tried that. Even though somehow part of me knew I allowed myself to be talked into, it's hard to believe now, a committee of residents. I was living in a housing estate, and a woman came up to me and she said, "We want you to be on our residents committee." And I went to one meeting and I felt like a Martian there. I know it's very hard to fit into Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's even more difficult to fit into a residents association. So I'm in that room, and all I could think about, I had this mad idea that I had a machine gun and I was killing them all. So I didn't go back again. But I was sort of thinking that that was the way to get sober. I'd have to somehow be a perfect husband and join the residents association. I was a teacher. I was teaching in university. That would be my job forever, because I had a wife and a mortgage and all that. And I felt very trapped, and trapped by what I thought the program was about, and trapped by, so I was, there was no way I was ever going to be happy, joyous, and free until I met Mark Kennedy. And that was a year of going to meeting solidly, thinking maybe it wouldn't be a bad idea to kill myself now that I'm not drinking, because life is still intolerable. I saw no way out. There was a film with Kevin Costner called No Way Out. And when I saw that film, I felt like him. He was a spy, and the Russians were cornered. He was a Russian spy, and they were cornering them. And I was cornered in sobriety. No more fun. Couldn't do the things I used to do. And one night I was driving out from Galway City, going out west, and Mark Kennedy was in the, Mark was dead now. We were talking about him before the meeting's over. And I had asked, after the year of going to meetings, I had knocked Mark Kennedy's door to ask him to be my sponsor, but he wasn't at home. There was another guy there, and I stayed with him that night. So instead of, I had the plan, the Reginald Perrin plan of leaving the country, leaving my wife and kids, getting in an old car and going to England and going missing. That was my way out. But instead I went and asked this guy to be my sponsor, but he wasn't at home. But Frankie and Brennan was, and I said to Frankie and Brennan that I was thinking of going to England. He said, "Well, maybe go tomorrow, because there's a guy up in up one of the housing estates in Galway City who's in a bad way with drink, and he wants to go to a meeting." So I said, "All right," and I went up and we picked up this fellow and took him to a meeting. I don't know if he ever got sober or not, but I didn't drink, and I didn't go to England that day. Another day passed, and eventually I happened to be in the car with Mark, and he was my sponsor. And I was talking to him going out the road, and he turned to me, he said, and it was the most sort of freeing thing I think anybody ever said to me in my life. He said, "I'm confused when I meet you." He says, "I know you've got a big job in the university, but I see you more as a lad who'd rather be sort of knackering around buying and selling stuff." And I felt a great freedom come over me. For the first time in my life, I met somebody who wasn't telling me something that I didn't want to do. I had lots of stuff saying, "Oh, sure, you're sober now. You've got a family and buckle down and that." And this is a voice that's saying to me that you can be who you are. And that was completely out of my comfort zone, because I always felt like I have to be molded by society or by people, and then I feel bad and I can react against them. And I was very reactive and hated society and all the systems and banks and all that stuff, police and governments. And here's someone saying to me, "Well, what about, what do you want to do?" And I said to him, a few days afterwards, I said to him that I wanted to, in an ideal world, which I can't do, of course, because I'm married and I've got this job and I've got a mortgage, but in an ideal world, I'd like to make musical instruments. And he said, "Why don't you do it?" And I was immediately trapped, because somebody's calling me on my bullshit. Why can't I do it? And I said to him, "Well, I want timber that's very hard to get." So the next day I met him, and he said to me, "I found a guy with some of that timber you're looking for, ebony, rare timber. You can get a supply of it in London. And I was terrified because he was calling my bluffs. And gradually and slowly, I realized that there was a way out for me, really. And I knew that the way out was through the steps, the fourth step, that I hated because once the word moral came into it, I saw sex. I saw upbringing of, you're bad, you pray to get rid of all these bad feelings, sexual feelings, or whatever it is. So I didn't want nothing to do with any of the steps. But I realized when I started talking to him and another guy that the morals was how can you be authentic and true to yourself? And it frightened the bejesus out of me, really, because my usual way of thinking was that I'm trapped, there's no way out. And now someone's saying to me, well, find out who you are and get the courage to do. And the thing was, you don't have to do it in a hurry. You can just do it slowly, a day at a time. Because I wanted a quick fix. Like the quick drink that gave you the instant, or even the thought of a quick drink would give me the instant freedom that I wanted. So the thought of a quick fix in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was, which where I got sober, was the idea was, okay, but take it easy. Take it easy. In Irish, you say toga boogie, take it easy, or toga, but do it. And I actually got some timber, so I was able to work on these instruments. And I got myself a little workshop, a very bad workshop, and I was working on them. And it gave me a great lift. I hadn't made a decision that I could ever pursue it as a paying thing, but eventually, I got more and more courage as time went on, and made a decision that I didn't like the teaching job. And I was again suggested to me, well, don't give it up yet. Give yourself a year before you make any major decisions. And I had commitments to people in the, I had lads doing, I had a couple of lads doing PhD degrees under me. I was their boss, and I wasn't going to let them down. So I stayed in the college and helped them to finish their courses. And that was totally different for me because I wanted the quick thing, get out quick and start off again. But I stayed with that. I stayed in the marriage until it got intolerable and eventually left the marriage. And that was terrifying as well. I can say it now in a sentence, but it brought all the other stuff. But people in the streets in Galway saying to me, go back to your wife. You ought to be ashamed of yourself, Small, it was a city, but it was a small city. We all knew each other. And people in AA were shocked that I was doing those things. But some little seed had started to grow inside me that it was okay to be me, and that I made a mistake by getting married, and I'd make amends. The nature of my amends wasn't saying I'm sorry, I'm leaving you. It was making a decision that I'm going to pay the mortgage for my wife and two kids. I'm going to start a business. I'm going to try and make a living for myself doing what I love, and managed to do that a day at a time, and ran two houses and worked long days. And started traveling, traveled to the States. And then when a few years sober, I was over there and used to go over for 6 weeks at a time and play music all over the States. And I wouldn't make a lot of money, but I got a lot of business out of it. I'd come back and lots of people would want some of the instruments I was making, and I got a living, I got a sort of a good living out of it. And that's when I would have met you, I think, those days. I'd be going playing in pubs, playing the instruments I made, and getting orders from that as well. And then I was also had moved from Galway, which had about, well, at the time it had about three or four meetings a week. I moved out to the country where there was only a meeting once a week. And there was two meetings per week near where I was, and both of them were on the same day. And I was 17 miles from both of them. So then I got the idea, well, it's a long way to go, but I need to keep going to meetings. Because I knew that had given me, I'd never been able to stay away from drink as long as I had when I was going to meetings. So Alcoholics Anonymous did for me what I wasn't able to do for myself, even though I hated a lot of the people and the way they talked and the religious stuff, sort of stuff, and God driving you home drunk and all that sort of stuff. That all went over my head. But in spite of that, I knew that by myself, I wouldn't have been able to do what I did. So I knew that the Alcoholics Anonymous had did from have done for me what I had couldn't have done for myself. So I decided to start a meeting in Listowel-Varna, which was not that far away. And that meeting ran for the best part of 40 years, I suppose. And that helped me a lot too. And life just went on, Got more another relationship that broke down, felt, that you hadn't really looked at the second half of the first step. Life can get very unmanageable, even though I wasn't drinking and I didn't take any drugs. I was 12-step by two doctors, two medical doctors, and they were trying to prescribe sedatives for me in my early days because they said, told me I didn't only suffer from alcoholism, I also suffered from anxiety. And I think I was wise enough to know in my core that if I took something else, it would be the same as alcohol for me because I wasn't sort of a social drinker. I was the first drink made me magic, and I'm so sure the first pill would have too. So I stayed away from that, and I stayed away from dope and all the rest of the stuff that was going around. So I went through the pains of growing up, really, and I often go back to that little place where I had the schoolhouse that Hugh was talking about. I bought an old schoolhouse, and with no running water, no electricity, dug a big hole in the back garden, and we all shit in the big hole, walking across a plank, So that was the early sobriety. And days went by and I got running water and that was a great day and put in a shower and was 100 yards from the sea, went swimming every day, shooting fish, eating good grub and grew a garden and at the same time then paid the bills for. And the kids got old enough and left then. I signed the house over to my wife and didn't take anything. So they were the living amends. And I have a good relationship with those two children now. And I have a relationship with their mother as well. We don't see each other very often. We're very, very different in every way. So we don't force anything, but I can meet her comfortably now. And then I don't know, I want to take up the whole meeting too much. I mean, I'm a sort of a selfish alcoholic because I like to hear other people's stories too. But I will say a little bit more about, years afterwards, I decided, I think I was about, I was late. I remember I moved from my workshop when I was 50 to where I live now, Kinvara. And I moved there specifically because I had another plan. And I didn't tell many people about what the plan was, but the plan was that I wanted to move up closer to a harbour so I was thinking of building a boat. And I started on that. It was a fairly big project. And I knew I'd be able to do it in a way because I'm a bit determined. So I bought a load of steel over from England, tons of steel, and built a steel boat. And 5 years after that, I launched it, and I went off for 5 years on the boat, and I rented out my house, and that kept me, afloat. And I was talking to Bridge earlier today now, and I think I was 60 something when I went across the Atlantic in the boat. I always had that in my head, but I told nobody. I went down to the place, well, I went down to the Canary Islands, and then I went down about 1,000 miles further down to the Cape Verdes and went across the Atlantic. And it was the best thing I ever did in my life, I think. I didn't tell many people what I was doing, but I told my children. And when I landed in Tobago, I was able to send them an email back to say I'd landed safely. And I like to share one thing about when I'm when, there's wonderful things in the sea when you're all I was all alone and picking up flying fish off the deck and eating them. And I brought speaker tapes with me. So I was still, even people often say, if you don't go to meetings, you're going to drink again. But I brought speaker tapes with me. So every so often I'd have a lad on, anybody could from all over the world. I'd download the speaker tapes from the internet before I'd leave and listen to them on the boat while I'd be eating my flying fish. So I was still in AA, even though I wasn't able to go to meetings. And when I landed in places like Tobago, there wouldn't be any meetings there either. People say there's meetings everywhere, but there aren't. There are places with no meetings. But I was able to manage. And when I go to a place where there was an English speaking meeting, I'd be delighted to go there and meet people and share whatever fears and phobias I'd have, and it worked great. And then eventually, after 5 years, then I met a woman, and in some ways, I'm sorry I ever met her, but in other ways, Yeah, she wanted a child, and we had a child together. And when the child arrived, then that was the end of my sailing days. And I sometimes miss it, but I don't miss the fact that I've got a daughter now who's 13 years old, and she's a darling. And we got on great together, and I've been with her every moment of her. I was almost like I hadn't the chance to be a father for my two older children because drink was more important than them. And I wasn't happy in the house either. So I didn't want to be going home at night time. I'd rather be out drinking. But later in sobriety, I got a chance of being a father. And it's been a very rewarding business, really. I remember when she took her first step. I was there for her. And I remember when she took her first spin on a little bicycle in a little woodland. I used to hold onto her with a rope, make sure she wouldn't fall. And then one day I took the rope off her and she didn't know, and she started cycling. And she looked at me and she was surprised, and she said, "I'm doing it by myself." I thought those little moments that are very precious that I missed the first time round. And I often say, there's nothing that, I don't think there's anything out there looking after me or anything, but if there ever was, it'd be a cosmic clown who would laugh at my attempts to make sense of the world. But those magic moments I remember. And now she's 13. She's a young woman almost now. When she was about 9 or 10, she becomes obsessed with horses, and I learned how to ride a horse with her. And I was 75 when I got on the first horse. So I'm saying that for people when they think that the world is finished is when you get sober or you lay down to drink. There are challenges, and it's great. And I had a lovely time riding with her on horses. I wasn't quite as good as her or as fearless, because I was very aware that if I hit the ground, my bones would break quicker than the horse would. But it didn't stop me anyway. So what else is going on? I'm wrecked now. My body's a bit wrecked with an autoimmune disease that I never heard of before in my life. But I have it in spades. It's a thing called, what's it called? It's fucking myalgia, polymyalgia. And a sort of a rheumatic thing. And it was quite dangerous. I was told in the early stages when I couldn't get up off a chair, and I didn't give in easy to that either. I didn't go Eventually, I went to a doctor, and the doctor couldn't diagnose it. And I went to eventually, I'll tell a funny story. Ireland is a funny country. And there's a lad who came to me many years ago, and I took him on a walk. And as a result of our walk, I suggested to him that he might come to meetings of AA. And he said to me that day, I remembered a little lane beside my house. He said to me, I don't want to get brainwashed." And I said, "Did you ever think your brain might want to be need to be washed?" And he remembered that. And that's what kept him coming to meetings. But 6 months ago or more, I don't know how long, nearly, he's an anaesthetist now in a hospital. And I couldn't get an appointment with a rheumatologist at all, even if I paid for it. But he knew that. But he was given this woman an anaesthetic one day, and he noticed on her thing that she was a rheumatologist. And when he had her on the operating theatre, he said to her, "Would you by any chance give a friend of mine an appointment?" And she said, "I will," he said. Tell him to call and see me." So that's how I got my appointment. And when she saw me, she told me what I had. She was quite good at her job. She's a little bit uppity, but she knew her job, and she decided I needed that if I didn't take steroids, I could die, because there's a part of the condition was that goes up into your head, and you can get a blowout in the head. So I decided to go on steroids, and they were grand, but then they were finished, and now it's back again. So I'm trying to manage that, and I'm going to see a lady that sticks needles in your body, acupuncturist, and whenever she's back from her travels. And I'm going to get some physiotherapy. I'm not up to these things. So, but in the meantime, on a daily basis, I can work away and do what I need to do. But I'm very fatigued sometimes. And if I feel anyway negative, I have to keep saying to myself, your old age is a luxury that's denied to many. And I'm coming up on 80 years old this year in a few months' time. So, you're supposed to get sick at some stage. But I'd never been to a doctor before and never took a tablet in my life until I took those steroids. So I had a big, it's a big decision for me. I've no regrets having taken them because they did help me through a bad time. So the future, I try and stay in the day. All the stuff that I found, like I had all the degrees in the world when I came into AA, and I saw the slogans everywhere, and I thought they were intellectual suicide, a day at a time, And now that that's what I'm using nowadays, it's a day at a time. Just for today, I'm all right. Just for today, I've loved my life with my lady here, Breach, and we get on great together. We play tunes together, and we have bits of crack and all that sort of stuff. And days go by, and I try and help anybody else that comes my way. I don't proselytize. I don't try talking anybody into this game. But if I think somebody needs to know, I let them know. And I don't drink and I don't take drugs, and I can manage life without it. So it's a so attraction rather than promotion. So I owe Alcoholics Anonymous, or for want of a better word, the people that I met through my life and all over the world, really. I traveled a lot, and I made connections with like spirits, what they call the fellowship of the spirit. It's so amazing that anybody who's stricken with whatever I have, the madness in the head, that drink works so well with. There's a very big common bond there. It's hard to figure it out. But the drink and dream figures it out. I had a drink and dream again a few days ago, and I was sharing it with Bridge and other people, and it's amazing the number of people who have the same drink and dream. That I dreamed that I've been drinking on and off, and I didn't tell anybody. Yeah, and I've been going to meetings, and nobody knew that I was drinking. And it's so real. And I share that, and then I get so many people come back and say they have exactly that same dream. It's like there's a Lego block, similar Lego block in all the people. Well, not all of them, but a lot of the people have that sort of. So I'm one of many. I'm not alone. And I'm a rabid. I'm becoming a rabid atheist. I used to just say nothing, but now I'm getting more vociferous about it, and it feels comfortable. Paste the stuff on Facebook that I know I won't get any likes for. But at this stage, I don't give a fuck. But I need to be true to myself. And my little girl is 13, and she's getting a little bit proselytized into school in sneaky Catholic ways. It's a multicultural school, but they have a chaplain who's a Catholic, and they bring them for meditation in the woods, and then they talk about the Catholic God. So I had words with her, but I'm not going to change her. And if I can, if those things are on, I'll go to the school and take her away. But I won't always know when they can get at a child in those ways. And there's a lot of things in Ireland now has come out over the years on physical sexual abuse, actually buggering children by priests and things, but they don't. It hasn't yet come out the mental abuse that children were subjected to, including myself. The idea at 7 years old that you can commit a sin, and that the only way to get out of sin is to go and confess it. That's really, really abusive, horrible, and I'm not saying it's any less than physical abuse, but it's definitely abuse because it tainted me, and in a way it made me a better person in another way when I sort of saw it for what it was, but it took my childhood away. And I'll just finish by saying that I had a priest came into me there, a local parish priest, powerful person in the community, asked to fix a chalice for him one day because I'm a handyman with soldering and craft work. And I told him I couldn't do it for him. And he said, well, somebody else said you could. I said, well, I can do it for you, but I won't do it for you because. And then he wanted to know why. And I told him, because the club you belong to stole my childhood. And if I was to do that for you, I'd be colluding with something that I believe is evil. And he was quite shocked, I'd say. He didn't show it. But he said to me, I'm very sorry you feel that way. And I was able to say him, and without too many emotions of anger, because I've gone through that period. I was able to say, well, I'm actually not sorry I feel that way. I feel very comfortable that I feel that way. And it would be like me fixing a syringe for a heroin addict and knowing that he was going to use again with it. I would be colluding and complicit with something that I think isn't something that I'd like to uphold. So I can do it now, but sometimes I go a little bit too far and then I get all angry again. But I have to do it that way sometimes to get to a place where I can do it with relative ease. And I did that in Alcoholics Anonymous over the years with the Our Father stuff. They say at meetings in Ireland, I tried many times through group consciousness to stop, to change it, but it's not possible. So now I can say with relative ease, if they do it at a meeting I'm at, excuse me, please, I just want to say that that's against the preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going for a piss instead. I think it's a much more spiritual act than me standing while you're negating the spirit of the preamble. And to be able to do that without getting all worked up, it's beyond my wildest dreams. I get a little bit worked up, but not too bad. And with practice, I think I get easier. So thanks for anybody. I'm saying it to the universe, all the lads and lassies I've met over the years on my travels and locally who have left gems of wisdom in my head and helped me through all and every circumstance. And no belief. I hope to be like Voltaire now when I'm dying. And they come to me asking me to renounce the devil. I'm going to say, at this late stage in my life, I'm not prepared to make any enemies. So I'm not going to say any more than that, Jan. That's enough.